So wonderful to see all your faces and be here to sit together and to reflect on the parsha of this week, the Torah reading, Mishpatim. So last week in Parsha Yitro, in Torah time, we were standing at Sinai in a state of heightened awareness and awe. What happened at Sinai was an experience that couldn't be captured in words. And as Aviva Zornberg explains, in the course of that experience, 10 very important utterances were spoken, Aserat HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments. But when we say we were standing at Sinai, we're referring to the experience that could not be captured in any narrative, in any verbal container. So last week, reflecting on the wordless experience of revelation, we noted that we are always, that the revelation continues to be there, to be received in each moment, even though we may be too distracted or too busy with other things to consciously register what is revealed. Or in Pema Chodron's wonderful metaphors, we could be sitting at the edge of the Grand Canyon with a paper bag over our heads, or thinking we just wish we had had that piece of chocolate cake at lunch, or having an argument in our heads again with a friend, rather than being there at the Grand Canyon. And this week, Aviva Zornberg explains that Parsha Mishpatim is all about words, about the laws. The people are not in direct contact with Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh as they were in last week's reading. Rather, the laws are heard, interpreted, translated, and recorded by Moses. And I have usually thought of Mishpatim as the boring companion piece to Yitro because it seemed like, oh, it's like reading a legal document, all these this list of laws. But I am grateful to Aviva Zornberg for describing this in a way that that we can experience as an equally moving revelation. So the words of Mishpatim come to us as embedded in the culture in which it was recorded and reflecting a very different set of sensibilities than we have now, but motivated by the same human drive we have now to find meaning in life, to seek some ease of mind and spirit in this life that is limited by our mortality, that's full of suffering and loss, joy and awareness, awe. This life where there's brutality and hatred and love and compassion. And we always get back to this question, how could I live life as a human being in this world that's filled with suffering and delusion, as well as with love and connection? Immediately after the overwhelming experience at Sinai, in which the people saw thunder and lightning, the blare of the horn and the mountain smoking, and Moses ascends into a cloud, we transition to the next parsha, Mishpatim, which begins, "These are the rules that you shall set before them." And the very first law begins, "When you acquire a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years. In the seventh year, he shall go free." Now, our first reaction may be shock and moral outrage. Didn't the Israelites just celebrate their liberation from slavery? Isn't the impulse to dominate and oppress other humans exactly what sent us down into Mitzrayim? The story is that Joseph's brothers sold Joseph into slavery. And that enslavement set off a chain of events that led to 400 years of oppression in Mitzrayim. And didn't we just receive the revelation and Ten Commandments that they prohibit murder and stealing, even coveting your neighbor's possessions. So I had to go back and reread and confirm that, there's nothing in those Ten Commandments that explicitly prohibits slavery. But one would think that the spirit of the law, combined with the experience of just having been enslaved, would make it unthinkable to enslave one's own brother or cousin, another Hebrew. So, needless to say, there are many commentaries. As I mentioned earlier, these laws are what was heard, interpreted, and transcribed by Moses, B'yad Moshe. And this is how, in that time, the voice of God was heard. And so, even though the revelation was not an experience that could be captured in words, civil society depends on our putting everything into words and laws. And so Moses translated the vo or whoever translated this experience of awakening into the language of the time and culture, which did include the institution of slavery. Now, the commentaries also take pains to note that this was a particular type of slavery. There were basically two ways that people entered into slavery. This is supposed to distinguish it from the type of oppressive labor that the Israelites suffered in Egypt. And also, the commentaries emphasize that these rules reflect an improvement on previous models of slavery, which did not have these same limits and constraints. In this context, the two ways that slaves are acquired are if somebody who is desperately poor and in debt agrees to work for a fixed period of time to pay off the debts. Or the second way is a court could order a thief to compensate through labor for stolen property. Most commentaries say that the Torah set up these boundaries but did not abolish slavery. That was left to later generations. You often see or hear this comment. And indeed, it took a very, very long time to abolish slavery. And still, when you look at what happens in the prison system, even in this country, you would have to say that slave labor still exists. So, as I wonder how to make sense not only of this, but all the other confusing and distressing questions of our times, my confusion was echoed in a question raised by Norman Fisher. That was at the end of his series of 10 talks that I mentioned last week about the teachings of Vasubandhu, a 4th-century Buddhist philosopher who explored the nature of reality. So after Norman had led this series of talks studying the work that illuminates our interconnection, that highlights our delusion in experiencing the world and ourselves as separate solid beings, Norman notes that the natural confusion would be, don't start a war, don't start killing, and if one gets started, don't keep it going, don't kill, don't hurt people. But what if you are brutally attacked? He says, what if your refusal to fight, if you're not engaging and responding with aggression, will give free rein to oppressive and destructive forces that will lead to catastrophic conditions? What if you have to fight back to prevent that? How much destruction do you need to inflict? Once you start to fight back, how do you know when to stop? And Norman left these as open questions, noting that he had no answers, but that he couldn't end the discussion about the nature of reality without acknowledging what was deeply troubling him. So, of course, I was troubled not only by these desperate situations in different parts of this earth, which so far blessedly are not in our immediate midst. But I was also distressed by Norman not being able to offer any answers, of course. So then I listened to a talk by Aviva Zornberg on this parsha, Mishpatim, and it was a talk she gave in 2016, but it's timely nevertheless. While she did not, of course, have an answer, she did offer a commentary on the laws that may help us to hold these confusing and conflicting feelings we have about violence and the law. She notes that when we came down from the revelation at Sinai to deal with reality of all the bad things that happened to humans, violence, destruction, death, pain, injury, that when we came down, we were dealing with the reality that pain and injury, both physical and psychological, can be inflicted on human beings by each other. This was the reality of the world. And the legal way of dealing with this, these things are given a name, nizikin, or damages, is dealing with how to respond when one person damages another. And our society has evolved the concept that the person who inflicts damages must experience some damage and pain in response. One doesn't have to agree, but this is how our society has constructed things. Some damages can be paid through fines and monetary compensation, but much of the law has to do with what Aviva Zornberg calls the social organization of violence. Certainly, imprisonment, capital punishment, depriving someone of the right to live freely, to live with their family, these are all controlled forms of violence. Zornberg is basing this commentary on an essay called Violence and the Word, written by an American Jewish legal scholar named Robert Cover. And she quotes Cover, who writes, When a judge rules, it takes place in a field of pain and death. This is a very graphic way of bringing our attention to what happens to the body of the person who is sentenced. Cover also notes that the very ritualized, formally structured process of the court system is designed in many ways to distance us from this raw awareness of the violence of the law, and also that these structures and formalities are intended to keep us from inflicting uncontrolled and unmonitored violence and cruelty, things that often emerge when people act impulsively out of rage, hurt, and anger. So, in our parsha as well, the story contained within the laws, these stories are also written in a way to put the brakes on our impulses toward cruelty and revenge. And what I did not realize until I took a closer look at this parsha is that the laws are often embedded in a narrative that makes the suffering of the victim palpable. The victim, or well, it makes human suffering palpable and makes us take this into account in our responses. For example, Zornberg points out the rule restricting the behavior of creditors, people who loan money, is told as a story. Not just the concrete details of the law. If you lend money to one of your own people, to the poor among you, if you take your neighbor's garment in pledge, so it's very specific about the other person and their clothing, you must return it to him before the sun sets. It is his only clothing, the sole covering for his skin. And then it goes on, in what else shall he sleep? It really gets into the details of what is life like for this person who's in debt, who's too poor to even have something to cover them in the night. Therefore, he cries out, if he cries out to me, I will pay heed, says Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, for I am compassionate. Zornberg points out that this story makes us feel what it's like to be cold, to sleep without a covering. And it also contains a familiar reference that resonates with something else that's very meaningful to us. If he cries out to me, God will hear his cry, just like God heard the cries of the Israelites in Mitzrayim when they cried out. For I am compassionate, Chanun. God reminds us of how much we depend on God's compassion, hopefully arousing in us this identification with the victim and the impulse for us to be an identification with Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and our own impulse to be compassionate toward others. Now, purely by coincidence, after listening to some of these reflections on revelation, laws, slavery, and compassion, I walked into my kitchen and heard an interview with another historian named Alan Guelzo, who had just published a book about Abraham Lincoln's vision of democracy. And the title of the book captured my attention, having just listened to Aviva Zornberg. The title of the book is called Our Ancient Faith. Now, the book is not about religion or the Bible, but about Abraham Lincoln's ideas and beliefs about democracy that sustained him through the most horrible crisis of this country, the Civil War. And he referred to these ideas that helped him steer a course as my ancient faith. And this prompted the interviewer to ask Lincoln, to ask Guelzo, unfortunately we can't ask Lincoln, to ask Guelzo, the author, about Lincoln, and whether Guelzo was saying that Lincoln's religion is this understanding of the republic. His religion is self-government, democracy, freedom to choose. And Guelzo answered, yes. And I don't think it's a mistake because Lincoln grew up in a very religious household. Personally speaking, he undergoes a kind of adolescent rebellion against that. He never joins a church. And people said that as a 20-something, he was something of an infidel, an unbeliever. But he knew what religion was. He knew what it meant to say that something was your faith, and particularly our ancient faith. He wants Americans to understand that the Declaration of Independence and its principles should be as dear to Americans as the tenets of Christianity are to Christians, of Judaism to Jews, and so on. The tenacity with which you hold a faith is the tenacity with which Americans should hold on to the ideas of the Declaration, the ideas of Republic, the ideas of consent. This is an ancient faith, and it is ours. So now this recently published book on Abraham Lincoln's ancient faith in democracy and freedom, now that's another layer or another set of connections that's part of this great complex web of interconnected narratives about ourselves and our human experience. And this narrative includes our capacity for revelation, for experiencing our interconnection, our lack of separateness. It also includes our impulses for revenge when we are hurt, our impulses for compassion when we see the suffering of others. It includes the story of oppression and liberation from slavery from long ago and from recent times, and on and on. It includes all the way that our legal system creates structures for dealing with the violent impulses that seem to be part of our heritage as well. So when I began to think about what will I say about Mishpatim, I initially thought about this parsha as a series of rules and regulations that that to me have previously been kind of like, I'll get through this, like I have to read through some kind of legal document. But now I recognize how this part of our Torah narrative contains reflections of the past and resonance with the future, the present, the future, in ways that I had not previously imagined. So thank you for the opportunity of being able to look more deeply into this parsha.